From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's World AIDS Day. According to a new report on the global spread of AIDS, HIV is in the process of reaching all human communities. It's not a question of if, but of when. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk to the editor of this new report, Dr. Jonathan Mann. He's the director of Harvard's International AIDS Center. Also from the forefront of AIDS activism in this country, a look back on over a decade of fighting. We talk with writer and activist Larry Kramer, who co-founded two of the most important AIDS activist groups, Gay Men's Health Crisis and ACT UP. Kramer has HIV. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Allegations of sexual misconduct brought against Oregon Senator Bob Packwood are currently under investigation by the Senate Ethics Committee. The panel announced today that it had begun a preliminary inquiry. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The allegations made by 10 women, lobbyists and former staffers who worked with the senator, are under investigation by Ethics Committee staff. Committee Chairman Terry Sanford, who was recently defeated in his re-election bid, says he instructed staff to begin gathering information immediately. Over the weekend, Senate leaders said they hoped the ethics probe would be wrapped up by January, when Congress convenes, saying publicly what many members are hoping in private. But it's unlikely staff can complete more than preliminary groundwork by the end of the year. Then the panel must decide whether to launch a full-scale investigation. Senator Packwood at first denied the allegations, but has since backed away from his own denials, blaming alcohol as a possible cause if the unwanted advances occurred. His office announced yesterday that he had voluntarily entered an alcohol treatment center on Sunday for an evaluation. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
The prospects for the economy 6 to 9 months in the future appear to be improving. The government said today that its index of leading indicators improved by 0.4% in October after falling in 3 of the previous 4 months. The index is computed from 11 different factors that reflect economic growth in their relatively near future. 6 of those indicators were positive in October, including fewer claims for unemployment benefits, a longer work week, a bigger backlog of unfilled orders, and stronger orders for equipment and consumer goods. Building permits also increased, a sign that construction is likely to pick up. In eastern France, violence broke out today during a rally of about 50,000 farmers in Strasbourg. Lynn Terry reports that several people were injured.
Farmers came from Europe, the United States, Canada, and Asia to protest the farm trade deal between the United States and the European Community. Most of them were peaceful, but a minority were armed with sticks and huge firecrackers. They broke windows, twisted signs, tore up paving stones, and damaged cars. At one point, dozens of farmers, mostly French, broke away from the march and tried to reach the European Parliament. They were stopped by rows of riot police who fired tear gas at them. One farmer lost his left hand in an explosion. Witnesses said he tried to pick up a tear gas bomb. The local officials said a firecracker went off in his hand. The march ended with a rally in a soccer stadium. There were so many firecrackers going off that the speakers couldn't be heard. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry reporting.
Stock prices declined slightly today after a session of mixed trading on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 11 points to close at 3,294. This is NPR News. 4 Venezuelan airliners were searched for bombs today after authorities in Caracas received anonymous threats. The threatened flights were scheduled from Caracas to Miami. 2 flights reached Miami and landed safely after the threats were received. Both were evacuated and searched by bomb-sniffing dogs. Another flight was diverted to Santiago de Cuba Airport in Cuba. A 4th flight was detained in Caracas. Miami police said the threats appeared to be part of the political turmoil in Venezuela. Air Force investigators are at the scene of 2 unrelated plane wrecks in Montana and Texas and are attempting to determine what caused each of the accidents. NPR's John Burnett reports.
Rescue teams have so far found no survivors among a total of 17 crew members involved in the 2 accidents. 2 military cargo jets collided during a refueling exercise last night and crashed in the Montana prairie about 30 miles south of the Canadian border. The 2 C-141B planes were carrying 13 crew members. Military authorities said 9 bodies had been found by mid-afternoon. An Air Force spokesman said neither mechanical problems nor weather appear to have caused the collision. The transport planes were based at McChord Air Force Base near Tacoma, Washington. In the second crash Monday night, a B-1B strategic bomber plowed into the rugged Sierra Vieja Mountains of West Texas. 4 crew members were aboard the unarmed plane, which is designed to carry nuclear bombs. An Air Force spokesman at Dyess Air Force Base in Abilene, where the bomber was based, said he could not confirm earlier reports that one crew member had survived. I'm John Burnett reporting.
The Pentagon said today that U.S. military leaders will cooperate with whatever plan the United Nations devises to protect relief shipments to Somalia. Spokesman Pete Williams said that the U.S. military would prefer to retain total command of its forces, but that the command issue wouldn't prevent the U.S. from being involved. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today is World AIDS Day. This day was first set aside in 1988 as a day for discussion, planning for the future, and remembering those whose lives were taken by the disease. There's a new report on the global spread of AIDS called AIDS in the World. My guest is the book's general editor, Dr. Jonathan Mann. He's an epidemiologist who directs the International AIDS Center of the Harvard AIDS Institute. He chaired the 7th International Conference on AIDS. The new report opens with this grim projection. We are entering a new, more dangerous phase of the AIDS pandemic. Dr. Mann says the major impact of AIDS is yet to come.
Well, for a couple of reasons, including the increasing number of people becoming infected with HIV and the time it takes for people who are infected to develop the disease AIDS, we'll see, for example, in the next 3 years, more people developing the disease AIDS than have developed AIDS during the entire history of the epidemic until now. We'll see, for example, the number of children orphaned by AIDS more than double in the next 3 years, from about 1.8 million children orphaned by AIDS today to nearly 4 million orphaned by AIDS by 1995. If we then look to the year 2000, which really isn't that far away, our experts project or estimate that there may be altogether between about 45 and 115 million people infected with HIV within just a few years, by the end of this decade. And so in all of these ways, the major impact is yet to come. And in our society in the United States, as well as around the world, I think we're increasingly aware of the ways in which this epidemic affects life, not only, of course, the lives of the people directly infected, but those around them and, indeed, the entire society.
Now, you write that the epidemic becomes more complex as it matures. What does that mean?
Well, what we wanted to explain there is that people continue to have a relatively simple view of the epidemic. People often are not aware, first of all, that the epidemic is dynamic. It's a very volatile phenomenon. It's been with us for a relatively short period of time, that is, in historical terms. And so it's continuing to spread to new geographical areas, and it's continuing to spread in all areas in which it already exists. But there's another dimension, which is this increasing complexity. As the virus is present in a society for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, it uses, in a sense, or it takes advantage of all the possible routes of spread and gradually reaches different groups in the population.
In some developing countries, it seemed that the AIDS epidemic was spread through heterosexual sex. It started in America being identified as spread through homosexual sex. Now more and more women are coming down with AIDS. What statistics do you have about the percentage of women who have contracted AIDS through heterosexual sex versus through contaminated needles?
Well, if we look at the worldwide picture,
Or perhaps through other ways that I'm leaving out.
Well, yeah, exactly. I was going to say, if we look worldwide, we can see that about 75 or 80% of the HIV infections are as a result of heterosexual transmission. A much smaller percentage is due to homosexual transmission. And what's important to underline here first is that women are being increasingly affected by this epidemic around the world. In 1980, about 20%, 1 in 5, of the people infected around the world was a woman. Today, it's about 40%, and it's just a matter of a few years before women will have at least an equal proportion of the infected people. Therefore, the epidemic is increasing, you can see by that, more rapidly in women than it is in men. Most of this transmission is heterosexual transmission. In addition, women are infected through blood transfusions if they are not screened. And the tragedy is that despite the availability of simple methods of testing to remove infected units of blood from the blood supply, despite that availability since really 1985, there are many parts of the world, the developing world, where safe blood is still not available. And the reason this is such a danger is if we look at a country like India, where the epidemic has been is beginning to hit with major force, in some of the surveys among blood donors, we can see in some places 30-40% of them infected with HIV, which means that the risk of receiving that blood, of course, is quite high. In addition to receiving blood and heterosexual transmission, women can be affected if they are exchanging needles and syringes because they are injecting drug users. And essentially, those are the routes of spread. The important point is the one that you made at the beginning, which is that women are increasingly affected by this epidemic in at least three ways. First, by being directly infected. Second, because when a woman is infected, if she is of childbearing age, there is a risk then that if she becomes pregnant that she could transmit the infection to her fetus or newborn, which puts an additional burden on her and on society. And the third dimension is that women are the major caregivers both in the formal and informal health systems around the world. These three elements constitute what's referred to as the triple jeopardy of women regarding AIDS.
Do you think that there's a developed consciousness in the United States that heterosexuals are vulnerable to contacting AIDS through sexual intercourse?
No, I don't think they're... I think people are still remarkably in a state of relative denial about this epidemic. In fact, to broaden that even further, if you'll permit me, I think that if we look at the global response, which I mentioned earlier, is slowing, despite the fact that the epidemic is dramatically intensifying, that we can see evidence of denial at virtually all levels. I think it's perfectly clear that a decade after this epidemic was recognized, or a little more than a decade, that we are still not in any meaningful way taking this epidemic as seriously as it deserves to be taken. And therefore, we're seeing country after country denying, for example, that it might have an epidemic. Let's take the example of Thailand. I remember when I was with the World Health Organization, I went to Thailand in 1987, and we talked about AIDS, and the government really did not believe that AIDS would become a problem in Thailand. Today, more than 500,000 Thai men and women are infected. That means that the epidemic in Thailand in just a few years has become more than 10 times larger than the epidemic in the United Kingdom. The same problem has happened in India, in Burma. And we can see countries like the Philippines, Bangladesh, Indonesia, that are just ripe for a major epidemic. In fact, in our book, we predict that there will be a major HIV epidemic in those large populous countries before the year 2000. Denial at all levels. So the large answer to your question is, I don't think that we collectively have taken AIDS nearly as seriously as it deserves to be taken.
Well, in keeping with what you're saying, there's an incredible statistic in your book that in 35% of the countries hardest hit, the heads of state have said nothing about AIDS.
Yeah, it reminds you a little bit of this country, doesn't it? Until just very, very recently, we've heard very little from our national, quote, leadership about AIDS. In fact, the entire AIDS epidemic has really taken place during the Reagan and then the Bush years. And President-elect Clinton gave a speech a few days before the election, which was the speech we needed 10 years ago in this country. It was the first time that we'd heard someone at that level talk about what needs to be done, talk about compassion, talk about the need to prevent discrimination, and really to finally say that we cannot tolerate in this country the loss of large numbers of young people without taking this problem just every bit as seriously as we would take any other major threat to our health and to our well-being. We've waited a long time, Terry, for leadership in this country, and unfortunately, we've been one of the countries without leadership at the top.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Jonathan Mann. He directs the International AIDS Center at the Harvard AIDS Institute. He's also the general editor of the new book, AIDS in the World, A Global Report. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Jonathan Mann is my guest. He's the general editor of the new report, AIDS in the World. I want to get back to the kind of global patterns of the AIDS epidemic and how the epidemic is spreading. When you look at the global picture now, where is AIDS moving that it hasn't moved before?
Well, the major area, the major new frontier of the spread of HIV in the last few years has been in Southeast Asia, in India, in Burma, in Thailand. I mean, these are three countries that in the mid-1980s, say 1985, you would have really had to hunt to find an HIV-infected person. There were very, very few infections. Today, the latest estimate is that there may be as many as 3 million people in India infected with HIV. We don't have very good data at all from Burma, but the latest study of injecting drug users found 60% infected with HIV. And in Thailand, at least 500,000 people are now infected with HIV, and the rates of infection are continuing to climb. One can really speak, I think, of an explosion of HIV infection in Southeast Asia. And I remember so clearly when I was with the World Health Organization in the mid-1980s, the extent to which these countries really felt that they would not be affected by this epidemic, that their societies did not have the features, the behaviors that would permit, in a sense, this virus to spread. Well, they were desperately wrong. And one of the purposes of this book is a cry of alarm, to sound the alarm for countries like Bangladesh, Pakistan, the Philippines, Indonesia, China. These countries are vulnerable, in some cases highly vulnerable, to an explosive epidemic because everything it takes to spread HIV is there. And so the question is no longer if they will have their epidemic. The only question is when.
AIDS is the first global pandemic in the human rights era. What is the significance of that?
Well, that's a very important point. I'm very glad that that we can turn to that element because there's a dialogue between public health and human rights in which AIDS has really played a seminal role. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights came out after World War II in 1948 and basically set a new standard for the respect and for the meaning of human rights in the world. Then along comes a major worldwide epidemic several decades later, and in seeking to fight the epidemic, we in public health have to be very much aware of human rights so that we don't violate human rights in the context of fighting AIDS. So the initial step of that stage of that interaction was we in public health basically trying to avoid abusing human rights as we went about our business of public health work. That was the first step. What now we have discovered, and this has taken us several years to recognize, is that actually basic conditions related to people's human rights, for example, the role and status of women in a society, actually are a major determinant of the rate of spread of the virus, so that you can really speak of an issue like unequal status and role of women as a condition which fuels the spread of HIV. Can I explain a little more?
Because with the example of women and how a lower status of women would help spread HIV.
Yeah, because this can sound abstract, and it's absolutely not abstract. It's very concrete. It comes down to this. A woman cannot say no to unwanted or unprotected sexual intercourse unless she has the economic and the social and the political power to say no and to mean no. Now, studies recently done in East Africa, Central Africa, and even in Latin America have shown that women who are monogamous and who are married are now becoming infected with HIV. Their risk factor is their inability to control their husband's sexual behavior. So they know about condoms and they know about AIDS, but because they can't get their husband to use a condom or to stop having intercourse with them, they are at risk of becoming infected. And in those settings, local women's organizations increasingly are working to change, for example, the laws governing property distribution after divorce. Because once a woman is able to divorce, because currently in those societies, divorce means literally economic death and civil death for the woman, once the possibility of divorce is real, the ability to negotiate that sexual relationship becomes real. And that would do more to reduce the spread of HIV infection than the further distribution of condoms or brochures. This is not just a problem limited, though, to developing countries. In North America and Europe, particularly among adolescents and young adults. The men are much more likely than the women to determine the with who, when, how, and where of sexual intercourse. In a situation of inequality, once we can see that there's an unequal ability to take the information and use it to protect oneself. And in that sense, the unequal role and status of women, which reflects itself also in commercial sex work and in many other dimensions, creates an increased vulnerability for women to become infected.
What do you think that we could be doing, but we're not doing yet, on a global scale that could help stop the AIDS epidemic?
I think the major piece that's lacking, and this is lacking at the national level as well as at the global level, and that's not surprising, I think, is the coordinated attack on the conditions which fuel the spread of the virus. It really comes down to what we believe is causing the further spread of this epidemic. Our diagnosis, our assessment, is that discrimination, not in the abstract, but in its specific and concrete manifestations, marginalization, stigmatization, lack of human rights and dignity, that those conditions in society create the conditions which fuel the epidemic. If you take any country in the world, and the United States is no exception, and you add HIV virus to that country, you will see the virus, in a sense, migrate towards and focus and concentrate in those parts of the society that are already marginalized. If we don't focus on those social conditions, if in the United States we don't provide access to good health care to all our citizens, if we don't provide access to good information, to social support, if we don't deal with the problems of drug use, if we don't deal with the problems of racism and homophobia, then it will not be possible to bring this epidemic under control. And you know what, Terry? Everybody knows that. The problem is that some people will say that's too utopian. It's not utopian to fight for women's rights. It's not utopian to fight against racism. It's utopian to believe that we can eradicate poverty. I don't think we can. But we can deal with the underlying conditions at the same time that we intensify and strengthen our regular programs, our condom distribution, our education, our counseling, our outreach.
We're all hoping that a vaccine is discovered soon.
Yeah.
That would, immunize you against the AIDS virus. If scientists did come up with such a vaccine, what would the immediate impact be? How long would it take before such a vaccine could really help stop the AIDS epidemic or even end AIDS?
Well, a lot depends on how the vaccine would be used. I mean, let's make some really optimistic assumptions. Let's assume that the vaccine provides lifelong protection, which is not at all clear. Let's assume that it provides high-level protection, kind of like measles vaccine does against measles, up in the upper 90s percentage protection against the infection. So give us a great vaccine. Now the question is, who's going to get it? Who's going to receive the vaccine? We have a recent experience with the hepatitis B vaccine in the world, which about 10 years ago was developed and licensed, but it cost about $100 per person for the three-dose series that you needed to protect yourself. As a result, until very, very recently, very little hepatitis B vaccine has been given in the developing world, which is where most of the hepatitis B in the world happens to be. Now, looking at that as a paradigm for HIV vaccine, unless there is a major change in the way we approach research and the products, the fruits of research, then the HIV, the AIDS vaccine, when it's developed, will be a vaccine for the rich and for the rich countries and for the rich people in countries. What we really need to do, if we want to think about bringing this epidemic under control with a vaccine, is similar to what was done with the Salk vaccine, the first polio vaccine, when it came out in the United States. Back when it came out in the early 50s, there wasn't enough the first year to give to everybody. So it was given to those children at highest epidemiological risk, at highest statistical risk of becoming infected. As more vaccine became available, more was used, and the epidemic in the United States was really brought completely under control. We have to do the same thing with an AIDS vaccine. We'd have to give it first to those people in the world who are at greatest risk of becoming infected, using, if you will, the world as our unit of analysis here. and then gradually, as more vaccine would become available, give it to those who were would be at lower risk. That would be to use the vaccine driven by epidemiology, not by the market forces. But that, I have to warn you, this simple idea carries within it a rather revolutionary concept, which is that a life in Brazil and a life in Zaire and a life in the United States are of equal value.
How far away do you think we are from an AIDS vaccine?
Well, everybody continues to use the elusive 5 to 10 years. I plead guilty. Back in 1985, when I was at WHO, when people asked me, I said 5 to 10 years, and that's still what I'm saying. More than 5 years, almost 10 years later, that's still what the major scientists are saying today. I don't think we can give a good answer. It's not for tomorrow. Some people believe it can't be done. I believe we will have a vaccine. I believe we will have drugs that will be increasingly effective with fewer side effects. But all this will take time.
What's your critique of American AIDS activist groups and where you think that they've been most productive and perhaps counterproductive?
Well, first of all, I think we all owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to AIDS activism. Because they have really taken the question of responsibility, of societal responsibility, much farther than people had taken it before. And it's very gratifying to see other groups interested in various health issues, in a sense, learning from some of those techniques from AIDS activism. But AIDS activism in this country developed in a context of a very negative environment. In other words, AIDS activism developed in opposition to, and they were very right to be opposed to, the status quo a la Reagan, a la Bush. In that environment, there was a need for activism. There was a need to struggle in the way that that struggle was done. And by and large, I think they've contributed a lot, particularly in terms of having us look again at how drugs are evaluated, tested, made available to people. That relationship between society and science, they've really made us all think, and that's been a very positive process with very productive changes. On the other hand, now we're facing a situation, hopefully, where we'll have a president, an administration, which will be saying the right things, which will be providing the kind of leadership that we've been desperately lacking. And it's I wonder a little bit whether the activist community now needs to, in a sense, be able to think a bit more creatively about what we need to do, because hopefully they'll be able to spend much less time criticizing or highlighting the inadequacies of what is. It's a little bit like a liberation movement that fights in a guerrilla war in the hills, and then finally it walks into the capital city and takes over, or is able to basically do what it wants. That job is a different job than fighting the guerrilla war.
Jonathan Mann, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Jonathan Mann is the general editor of AIDS in the World, a global report published by Harvard University Press. Dr. Mann directs Harvard's International AIDS Center. On the second part of our show, we'll be joined by AIDS activist and playwright Larry Kramer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up in observation of World AIDS Day, we meet one of America's first and most outspoken AIDS activists. At the very beginning of the epidemic, Larry Kramer co-founded Gay Men's Health Crisis. He later co-founded what became perhaps the most controversial AIDS group, ACT UP. Kramer is also a playwright. His play, The Normal Heart, was one of the first to discuss AIDS. His new play, The Destiny of Me, also about the epidemic, is now running off-Broadway. Kramer was diagnosed with HIV in 1988. A talk with Larry Kramer coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. There's been more positive news announced today concerning the U.S. economy. The monthly survey of the nation's purchasing managers indicates that American manufacturing surged during the month of November. NPR's John Edstey reports.
The purchasing managers index jumped to 55% in November. It was just above 50% in September and October. Any reading above 50% indicates that American manufacturing is expanding. The index is based on a survey of purchasing managers from more than 300 industrial companies in the United States. They answer questions on everything from employment to new orders. Today's news of growth in the manufacturing sector is just the most recent of a number of positive reports on the economy in the past few days, including a jump in personal income and consumer confidence. Also today, the Commerce Department reported that the Index of Leading Indicators, which is designed to predict future economic activity, increased in October after falling in three of the past 4 months. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
In Moscow, Russian President Boris Yeltsin has survived efforts to impeach him by hardliners at the opening meeting of the Russian Congress. A plan by Yeltsin to cut back on presidential powers while keeping on with his economic reforms came under heavy criticism, even from some of his own supporters in parliament. Meanwhile, U.S. government officials have suspended Russia from an export credit program because it has not paid its loans on time. Secretary of Agriculture Edward Madigan says that he is confident that Russia will make its late payments and be reinstated in the plan. Government health officials say that two experimental AIDS vaccines are ready for the next stage of clinical testing. NPR's Joe Palca reports.
Both vaccines have successfully completed initial testing to show that they are safe. Now they will be the first to be tested to see if they can help healthy people mount an immune response that will protect them from becoming infected. 330 healthy volunteers, some of whom may be intravenous drug users or others known to be at risk for infection, will participate in the trial. Each will get regular blood tests to see if the vaccine is working. The two vaccines are genetically engineered pieces of the AIDS virus. One is made by the U.S. company Genentech, and the other is made by a collaboration between the U.S. company Chiron and the international pharmaceutical giant Ciba Geigy. Volunteers are currently being screened for the study, and the first shots should be given next week. I'm Joe Palca in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 11 points to close at 3,294.36 on volume of more than 259 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. In Geneva, the UN Human Rights Commission has criticized Serbian officials for their policy of so-called ethnic cleansing in former Yugoslavia. The commission said that states are to be held accountable for violation of human rights in regard to the forced removal of non-Serbian people from their homes in Bosnia and Croatia. The commission also called for an urgent investigation of mass graves in parts of Croatia. In New York City, the UN Secretary General has confirmed that the government of El Salvador has provided a detailed plan for purging its armed forces. Meanwhile, Tom Gibb reports from San Salvador that UN officials are now confident that a deadline of December 15th for disarming leftist rebels can be met.
This month, President Alfredo Cristiani has to carry out a purge of officers accused of abuses. A secret list was drawn up by an independent civilian commission and is believed to contain the names of more than 100 senior officers. So far, the purge has not started, but President Christiani has provided the UN with a detailed plan of how it'll be put into effect. In response, leftist rebels are today demobilizing more troops. They also have to give the UN a detailed arms inventory and start to destroy their weapons. UN officials, however, are confident the peace process is now on schedule to meet the December 15th deadline for rebel disarmament. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
Officials of the Bush administration have accused China and Taiwan of using their currencies in order to gain unfair advantages in international trade. The Bush administration also forecasts that the nation's trade deficit will climb above $100 billion again next year. Both the charges against Taiwan and China and the forecast of a bigger trade deficit were contained in a report by the Treasury Department. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's World AIDS Day. There are thousands of groups in America devoted to AIDS education and activism. The one generally considered to be the first, Gay Men's Health Crisis, was created in the very early days of the epidemic. My guest is the co-founder, Larry Kramer. He later co-founded ACT UP, one of the best-known and most controversial AIDS activist groups. Kramer is also a writer. Before he became an activist and playwright, he was best known for his screen adaptation of D.H. Lawrence's Women in Love. His 1985 play, The Normal Heart, was about the early days of the epidemic. Now his companion play, The Destiny of Me, is running off Broadway. The main character, Ned Weeks, is HIV positive. So, by the way, is Larry Kramer. As the play opens, Weeks is in the hospital, where an experimental HIV therapy will be administered by a top AIDS research doctor who Weeks previously condemned for not moving fast enough and for not fighting against the bureaucracy. The doctor is modeled on Anthony Fauci, the government's top AIDS researcher. Kramer told me he started to empathize with Fauci after Fauci invited Kramer and several other activists into the decision-making process.
He invited us inside, and when you get to know a person, that makes hate harder. He's a genuinely likable person, and I think we grew genuinely fond of each other, so it's kind of hard to call a man that you feel that way about a murderer. I will say I've learned a lesson, and I don't know that I ever want to go inside again, that I feel I'm much more useful as a gadfly, as someone from yelling from the outside. I wish I did not know Tony so well. I wish I did not know Dr. Gallo so well, or the cast of characters that I've come to know and respect.
Well, I wonder if knowing some of the doctors and researchers better than you used to, and having them become more human, more likable to you, if that's given you any second thoughts about some of the tactics of ACT UP, the group that you co-founded.
I have to say no. I don't think that I will defend the tactics of ACT UP and very strenuously. I think that without those tactics, we wouldn't have been invited inside in the first place. We would never have had the opportunity to be listened to, or to be taken seriously. We would not have been able to. The best instance is that there's a drug out now called from Bristol Myers called DDI, and they're about to release another one called D4T, and these are both valuable alternatives to AZT, which is a pretty useless drug from Burroughs Wellcome, and those two good drugs from Bristol Myers are out there because of us. Literally, we asked to meet with Bristol Myers. I wrote a letter to the president, Richard Gelb, the CEO, and I sent him our usual packet saying all our good things and also about our protests, and he was nervous, but he opened the door and we sat down with the scientists, but again, we couldn't have gotten in the door if Gelb hadn't been frightened of us. And it's the good cop bad cop routine that I think almost every successful corporation uses at some time or another.
Can you give us a really kind of brief summary of what you've proposed, and what you've proposed, basically the equivalent of a Manhattan Project, to help find the cause and a cure for AIDS?
That's correct. I go further than that in a way now. The Manhattan Project I don't know that you could really do a Manhattan Project anymore. That was to discover, to make an atom bomb, and they hadn't even smashed the atom at that point. And so it was basically a bunch of people beginning, starting with nothing and going into the wilderness. And, of course, we're now 12 years into this plague, and there has been a certain amount of science that's been done, so it's we're not at the beginning anymore. But what I did call for is the establishment of what I call joint chiefs of AIDS, that I didn't think an AIDS czar was enough anymore, one person, and that you had to divide the areas of responsibility into research, and in one column would be research, and that would also include drug development, drug approval, and clinical trials. And in the other column would be everything else, i.e. insurance, health problems, discrimination, legal problems, the social issues, education. That part could, I think, be well tended by an AIDS czar. But the research part had to be divided up into these four areas, and I put forth names for the four areas. Dr. David Baltimore to be in charge of AIDS research, Dr. David Kessler, the current head of the FDA, to be in charge of drug approvals, Dr. Roy Vagelos, who is the CEO at Merck, the most successful drug companies, to be in charge of drug development, and for clinical trials, which is the means of testing all of these drugs to see that they're effective as quickly as possible to test them, in which you need enormous networks around the country and a huge patient population to give the pills or the needle sticks or the IV too. I proposed a man, Admiral James Watkins, who was on the Reagan AIDS Commission, and I must say that this has all gone down quite well. David Baltimore, I guess, has got a little bit of a controversial past, but he's also one of the smartest scientists in the entire world. He's got a Nobel Prize for discovering reverse transcriptase. And everywhere I go, everyone I talk to, when you say, who is the smartest man in this whole area, everyone always says David Baltimore. And when I met David Baltimore, he said he thought that AIDS could be cured. And that is a major statement from a major scientist. Mm-hmm. And indeed, he's the only major scientist who's been willing to go on record as saying it. He also said he would like to be the man to go down in history to discover it. And I like that kind of attitude.
You were very critical of the Reagan and Bush administrations.
Oh, who wasn't?
When it came to AIDS. Yeah. What are your hopes for the Clinton administration?
Well, I have been very depressed for a number of years, and I find myself getting very excited lately, and I'm not a Pollyanna person. I think we're going to have a cure, and I think that if Clinton allows certain things to happen, and if he doesn't, then we're not going to have a cure. What's given me the most hope so far is that the person he has put in charge of the AIDS transition team is a man called Tim Westmoreland, who is the AIDS aide to Representative Henry Waxman from California, who's head of the House Subcommittee on Health. And Westmoreland is, quite frankly, the smartest man in government on AIDS, bar none. He knows what has to be done. He knows how government works. He knows how legislation works. He knows how Congress works. He knows all the leading players. And for the Clinton people to have identified him so quickly, located him, and put him in charge of this, because he's not a well-known name and he's not his name is not in the newspapers all the time, just gives me such excitement and hope that they found the best person. And they said, okay, you're in charge of the transition. Give me your ideas.
If you're just joining us, my guest is activist and playwright Larry Kramer, and his new show, The Destiny of Me, is off-Broadway in New York. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer and AIDS activist Larry Kramer. His new play is called The Destiny of Me. He's also a co-founder of Gay Men's Health Crisis and ACT UP. You've been diagnosed with HIV. Well, you were first diagnosed with that in 1988. Have you had any symptoms, or is it just testing positive?
Well, I've not had any opportunistic infections. There have been, you know, certain things that have that people with this condition habitually experience, but nothing of any earth-shattering import. I've been very lucky thus far, and I believe I have been infected since easily the late 70s, so I'm what's called a long-term survivor of one sort or another, and I don't know why I'm not dead. And, of course, this is one of the things we've been most anxious to ask the government to study.
How has having HIV affected your sense of priorities as an activist and your sense of what you as an individual should be devoting your time to?
Well, I would rather answer that by saying it's made me very precious, et cetera, et cetera, and I want to finish my life's work, and which is to write certain things about it. But it has taught me an enormous amount about life and humanity and human beings, and most of what I've learned has not been terribly pleasant. I just have seen humanity at its worst. I have seen bureaucracy at its worst. And I've seen bigotry at its worst. And I've seen precious little countervailing charitable acts of love to balance any of that, to the extent the awfulness has been allowed. Yes, of course, there are wonderful people who have been working on the front lines. But for 12 years, two wretched presidents refused in any way to help save lives and allowed other people to intentionally become sick so that they too might die. And that's a very strong indictment. And it's just, I did not start out to be an activist. I did not start out to be indeed political. I was a businessman. I was in the film industry. I was assistant to the presidents of both Columbia and United Artists. I went to Yale. I was on my way to making a great deal of money. I was not a gay man first by any manner of means until I became involved in fighting AIDS, and because someone close to me died. And suddenly, I was none of these things. I was no longer the white man from Yale. I was a faggot without a name, and I learned very quickly what black people must feel when they're called niggers and spics for the Hispanics. I mean, I really have learned what bigotry is like up close. It has been a grotesque lesson. This is a country that is so incredibly hateful and racist, and if Bill Clinton can make one tiny bit of a dent in the attitude of that, then perhaps we can begin to pick up the pieces.
Larry, do you remember how you first heard about AIDS, the first signs of it that you saw or read about?
Oh, yes. There were, I guess, several incidents. The first official real quaking in my stomach was in July of 1981 when the first article appeared in the back pages of the New York Times announcing the discovery in gay men of a rare cancer, and it was announced by a doctor whom I knew at NYU. And I rushed up to see him, and he told me what was going on, and I just knew then that, boy, this was just going to be awful. And then, as he told me about it and what was happening, my mind went back to instances over the preceding couple of years where I had had friends who were mysteriously ill, lovers carrying their lovers around literally in their arms from doctor to doctor, from hospital to hospital, begging for, have you heard of anything that this could remotely resemble? And it has been 12 years of horror, death after death after death. One does become inured to it in a strange sort of way. I don't feel near the appalling horrors on a basis as I did in those early days.
You feel like you've adjusted to death, and that's probably not a good thing to adjust to.
It certainly isn't. It certainly isn't.
Have you counted the number of friends that you've lost, or did you just stop counting?
I stopped counting. I used to keep a little book, and I forgot even what year it was when it reached 500, and I just stopped at 500. But you have to remember that having co-founded GMHC and having founded ACT UP and just being so well-known in the community, I probably, you know, I knew more people than your average gay person. But I think by now there isn't anyone in New York who has not certainly had many dozens of people lost.
My guest is AIDS activist and playwright Larry Kramer. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Mike Schuster reports from Moscow, reports on the request by Boris Yeltsin to Parliament. He wants 18 more months to accomplish economic reform. He wants to continue moving toward a free market economy there. Robert Siegel talks with a newspaper editor from Sarajevo in Bosnia about the difficulties of publishing during a siege. John Greenberg reports on a proposal by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, an outreach program for listeners and viewer comments, reaction to broadcasts on public radio and television. And Elizabeth Arnold on the Senate Ethics Committee, beginning an investigation of charges of sexual harassment against Senator Bob Packwood.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. You're just joining us. My guest is Larry Kramer. He's an AIDS activist. He co-founded Gay Men's Health Crisis and ACT UP. He's also a playwright, and his new play, The Destiny of Me, is now running off-Broadway in New York. I want to get back to your new play, The Destiny of Me.
Good. Thank you. I want people to come and see it.
The main character in the play is in the hospital getting an experimental HIV treatment. And but the character, like, whenever he passes a certain hospital, he always thinks, this is where I'm going to die. And he's always thinking about things like the cemetery plot that he's bought and why he bought it there and who else is buried there. Do you think these kinds of thoughts a lot yourself, or is this just the character? And like, what kind of balance do you have with yourself about thinking these kinds of things and just like suppressing it, thinking maybe it's really not useful to think about that? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, how do you handle that yourself?
Well, let me say this about the play, that you're making it sound very depressing and that I hope that it's funny. I hope that there's a lot of humor in it. And it's basically less about the hospital and more about the 50 years of my growing up. It's really about a man's journey to the acceptance of his homosexuality. The theme of the play is sort of, you know, it takes you years and years and years to come to accept yourself, and then the plague comes along and kills you, which I think is the sad story that most gay men now have to face. So it's really about my mother and father and my growing up with my brother. The character that's based on me, in fact, is played by two actors to cover the time span. And The being in the hospital is just an excuse for a place for him to
reflect on the past.
And to compare the worthlessness of the treatment that he's taking with the worthlessness of the psychoanalytic treatment that was meant to have cured him of his homosexuality 40 years ago. But to answer your question, I don't think any of us can stop thinking about death, and our lives are completely drowning in it, quite frankly. And one reason I moved to Long Island was to get a certain amount of relief from the stress of being surrounded by so many sick people, having to go to the hospital all the time to visit, seeing every time you go to the doctor, walking into a waiting room filled with cadavers, passing hospitals, knowing who's in there, worried that you're going to be there, too. I have writing to finish, and I just need to get that out of my mind. I don't think that no matter how great a state of denial you can place yourself in, you ever completely, as a gay man today, can escape all of these fears, even if you're HIV negative, because are you and for how long, or who among your friends is going to get sick, and you want to have a lover, you know, is your lover going to be healthy, or people you want to have sex with, are they going to be healthy? I mean, you can't ask an entire world to stop having sex. It just isn't realistic. So how do you learn to live with these terrible swords of Damocles over your head? I don't have the answers. I don't know.
Do you know what you'll be writing next? Is there a project you're working on now?
I have so many projects that I don't know that I have time for them all. But there's nothing like a little pressure anyway, I love working under pressure, so that's been useful. Barbara Streisand is going to be making a movie, hopefully next summer, of The Normal Heart, and I'll be working with her on that and the screenplay of that. And there will be a movie, although it's a little too early to talk about it, of The Destiny of Me, which I'm also very pleased about. And there's going to be a production of The Destiny of Me, a major production of it in London, I believe, and that's going to be exciting. And I've been working for about 10 years on a very, very, very long novel called The American People, which I will write till the day I die. It's sort of Proustian, you know, when he finished it, he died. That's, I think, what's going to happen with this book. I feel it's almost my responsibility to write about AIDS stuff and about what it's been like to be gay in this time in history. And fortunately, I'm still healthy, and I feel like I've been given this opportunity to write this story because I was, for whatever reason, put on the front lines of the battlefield when the war started in 1981, and there are not many writers of us who are still alive, and I know where all the bodies are buried, both symbolically and literally, and that I have to somehow, and it's an enormous challenge and an enormous task, I must somehow find a way to make art out of all of this into the best, damn, biggest, greatest novel I have it in me to write, and I'm enjoying that challenge.
Well, Larry, I wish you good luck with your writing,
Thank you.
I wish you good health, and good luck with your new play.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Bye-bye.
Larry Kramer's new play, The Destiny of Me, is running in New York. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Joan Tuohy, and Roberta Shurrock, with Sue Weinstein. Naomi Person directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, one of the founding fathers of Israel reflects on his nation's history and the prospects for peace in the Middle East. We'll meet Abba Iban, Israel's first ambassador to the United Nations and former ambassador to the United States. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.